What's up, boo?
You my boo-boo?
You my boo? You my boo this afternoon?
I'm excited that I get to talk to you on bath night.
Oh, that's why I'm open during the day.
That's what I figured. How long does bath night last?
As long as I want it to.
As long as I can make it.
Sure, man.
Bath night for me, it lasts about 22 seconds.
It's a pretty quick bath.
I mean, sometimes you just gotta get it over with, work on, move on to other things.
And sometimes you're just tired and you just want to go to sleep. I get it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So.
It's just all about getting wet. So whether you stay in for 45 minutes or just dip in, I mean.
Exactly. I got an email today asking me if I would like to do live reads for an e-cigarette.
He should, man.
I mean, if they're going to pay me, I will.
Of course.
I mean, why not?
Have you ever smoked cigarettes?
Oh, yeah. I still smoke when I drink, so.
Oh, okay.
So, I'm assuming that's why they picked me.
I've never been a big smoker, but, you know, I'll put a dip in.
Yeah, I dipped a little in high school, but I've smoked off and on since college. I was never super heavy. Like, maybe when I lived in Indiana, I smoked more than a pack a day, but that's because I lived in Indiana.
Well, like a morning smoker, the people who wake up and they just light it, and it's like, God damn, man, really?
Yeah. My most consistent was I would come home after work when I was working nights, and I'd have one at like 9:30, you know, and then I might have another one before I go to bed, but I go all day without it. So, and I gone through periods where I smoked more. Like when I first moved out here, my grandma was real sick. You know, I was smoking more frequently. I was smoking at work and stuff like that, but I'm not, you know, it was never super hardcore. I was smoking every day, but I wasn't smoking a ton. So,
right. Well.
So
they picked a good man then.
I guess they did, Jason.
Outside of that, you doing well?
Yeah, you?
Yeah, of course, man.
What's new?
This is pretty cool. Been working on like behind the scenes on this new series for Baseball Prospectus. Like a new advanced scouting series where we're gonna, you know, take the last 10 games of a major league hitter and break down how to attack them.
Right.
And so that's finally starting to come together. I think we're starting to get a construct that I think will work, and I'm going to start giving out assignments so that we can have these prepared for the postseason push. So it's kind of a playoff preview. And we've talked about it before, but I finally have the construct in place that I like. I've been, you know, talking to people in baseball a bunch about it. And so I feel good about it. I feel really good about it.
That's great. Are you going to get any in-person eyes on guys, or are you going to do it all off video?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to get some in person if it's possible, but I mean, I'd like to take the last 7 to 10 games that a player is played. I'd like to break down everything that they're doing, how to go about attacking them, both, you know, against left-handers and right-handers in certain situations.
Right.
You know, I want to bring in some statistical analysis as well, which we have at Baseball Prospectus, but I want to rely heavily on the scouting side of it. You know,
sure.
Kind of just an advanced report, I think it'd be pretty cool. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I'll definitely use those for our playoff coverage and pimp it good, too. So,
awesome, man. I appreciate it.
So, yeah.
But Kansas City was fun. I meant to tell you, I got to hang out with Passan a little bit.
He's such a dork.
Yeah, man, he showed up. You know, he showed up all professional with his little tie clip and his little haircut.
Uh-huh.
And his little shoe shine and his little smile. And then he left and went and put on cargo shorts and suntan lotion and goober.
Did he smell like coconut then?
He smelled great.
Yeah. Yeah. he's a treat.
Yeah, he absolutely is a treat. He's a treat of a human.
Well,
The event was good, though.
As Mort and I had this conversation at the ballpark the other night, and there's like an old Royal Scout, like, you know, sitting in front of us. I mean, this little old man, you know, like, and he hears us talking. We're talking about, we're going through the core of their lineup, and we're going, oh, shit, what organization doesn't want those seven guys, you know? What's their hole? Right field, second base. What can you fill? Right field, second base. You know? I mean, it's like, it's...
Did the guy turn around and go, hey, guys, shut the fuck up?
No. He just looked, and then he went back to doing whatever he was doing.
It's probably the guy that signed Starling.
Yeah, I was a pro guy, but I mean, he was, he probably turned around because I was saying fuck a lot, but.
Well, I mean, this came up in the event a lot. It came up like, first of all, there were people who assumed that the Royals don't have an analytics department for whatever reason, but they had four of the members of the analytics department there. Extremely bright guys, doing a lot of advanced stuff that I don't think people outside realize. You know, then a lot of people were like, man, what do you think about the Royals? You know, they had this massive farm system a couple of years ago, but it hasn't developed anything. And it's like, even Joe stepped up and he's like, what the fuck do you mean it hasn't produced anything? Look at the talent that they've been able to put on the field. Look at the young core of talent that the Royals have at the major league level, not to mention the guy that they were able to flip to bring in a guy like Shields.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I mean, we were talking about, would you rather watch the Astros right now or would you rather watch the Royals?
You know, I would much rather watch the Royals, but I'll tell you what, if you've watched the Astros at all the last couple of weeks, I mean, I saw them in person at the beginning of August, and it's not as bad as it was, at least in terms of the pure talent level that's on the field. They actually have a little bit of pitching. You know, I mean, Cozart's been pretty good. Oberholzer's been really good for them. It's kind of a weird, you know, I mean, he's a straight over the top lefty, but it seemed to be working. And they've got a couple of guys in the lineup that can hit a little bit. I mean, and so it's not as miserable as it was watching in like May and June, but I don't think it's even close. I mean, the Royals are a real team.
I mean, they got real uniforms and everything.
You know, I mean, I was thinking about this today because we had Porter, you know, we had Bo Porter every couple of weeks. And so I was thinking about this today with it, and you know they're excited. They want to. They feel like they've identified a couple other core guys, or at least from what he said, you know, for their lineup from this year. And they've got a couple of guys that they'll probably bring up in September. I'm assuming Springer and Singleton are your chances once the minor league season's over and all that. But I kept thinking, man. Well, so what happens if you have injuries? You know, because if you think about it, I mean. Shit, that's what happened in Kansas City. I mean, they have, what, four left-handed pitchers, and three of them got hurt, you know, and the other one just can't find the strike zone. They traded him to Tampa, you know. I mean, Duffy got hurt. Dwyer got hurt, right?
Yep.
And Duffy.
Lamb got hurt.
And Lamb, yeah. And Lamb's still not back. Duffy, I guess, I didn't see it last night, but he threw the hell out of the ball. I guess he was really good last night.
Yeah, he's got incredible arm strength. I don't think Lamb is coming back. I mean, yeah. I think that ship has sailed. But, I mean, yeah, they've had a problem, you know, developing starting pitchers. But, I mean, that's not uncommon. You know, it's hard to develop pitchers. That's why you get as many as you possibly can. I like their chances with a guy like Zimmer. You know, I like their chances with a guy like Almonte, even though he's pretty far along. I mean, I think that they're able to identify talent, and I think that they still have a really good system. I was trying to push that point to the crowd, but the crowd was already, like, beaten down, a lot of them, with, you know, just I guess they read a lot of people who, you know, like to bash the Royals. I mean, I think that the Royals have taken positive steps. Now, to open it up a little bit, is 7 years too long to get to this point?
Yeah, I mean, if it takes that long, I mean, it depends on how much. Well, what's your ownership commitment to getting to there? You know,
I just think that, you know, to turn a franchise, to build the farm that they did, to start to take steps forward. I think it sucks that it's happening in what, year seven, as opposed to year four or year five, because, you know, if this happens earlier on, then you might be able to envision, okay, give us a couple more years. You buy a couple more years. At this point, I mean, do you give them more time?
Well, they got another year left on their deal, and I think the fact that they've at least turned it around to the point where they're competitive this year, they get another year. I mean, I'm not sure what, you know, their manager's contract's up, so I don't know what they do there. But I think that the general manager gets another year. I mean, that's, you know, they're going to end up with like 85, 86 wins. I mean, that's a big leap over where they were last year too. You know, it may not be, you know, a playoff caliber team, but it's, you know, it's close. And I mean, it's not, you can't, you know, I know everybody's focused on what's going on in the Central with, you know, Detroit is obviously going to be good next year, and Cleveland, you know, has a chance to be better. But man, you know, Miggy hurt his hip today. You know, what happens if that if Detroit has a catastrophic injury, you know, or if two of their starters regress, or if, you know, what we're seeing is the beginning of the downfall of Verlander this year, you know? I mean, you can't worry about that shit as far as I'm concerned. You've got to build the best roster that you can. And I think that they're close enough that I wouldn't – I mean, you could have made a better argument, I think, 3 years ago for cleaning house than you can right now, just based on where they are. Because you've seen it through to this point. Why not see it through the last year? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they got a ton of talent. I mean, would you say 7 years is enough?
I think 7 years is a lot, man.
It is.
But, I mean, the fact that they're starting to see positive steps, the fact that, you know, Hosmer has been a much different hitter in the second half. Maybe you think that Moose can get there eventually. You know, you get Perez healthy. You fill some gaps at the major league level. Now, I think part of the criticism, and it's been warranted, is that, yeah, they've been able to build a farm, but have they been able to augment those young players with acquisitions on the major league side? You know, it doesn't help the fan base who see things in a very black and white way when you look at Shields, and that's good and all, but then you look at, you know, one value metric or whatever, and you look at Will Myers and what he's doing under team control for all those years. You can say that trade was a complete, you know, shit show, which we've talked about and we disagree with. But, yeah, I think 7 years is too long, man. I'm just being honest. And if I were in that front office, I would want it to be 9 years or 10 years or however long it's going to be. But, I mean, this is the time of year where, you know, I'm starting to get kind of questions about this from people. I'm starting to get, like, people in the industry sending, like, hey, well, what have you heard about this? What have you heard about this? Because you start to look at what jobs are going to be open or what could be open. I mean, right. There was the thing about Seattle. You know, they've been losing a lot more after they were winning a lot more. They're calling up Taiwan Walker, which some people think is a desperate move, much like the Zunino call up.
I don't know. I mean, he's pitched awfully well at AAA. So.
Yeah, but why bring him up before? I mean, I understand, like, giving him a taste at some point. I mean, but I get it. I just think that it's a move that I don't know why they're making it. I don't think they have to make it.
Well, when are you going to give him the taste? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, are you going to give him the taste now on his regular day to pitch? You're going to let him make one more start in the minors and then bring him up next week? You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know, rosters expand Sunday. So if you're going to give him a taste this year, why not just do it now? You know, I mean, I don't really have any problem with that. I don't have any issue with the way that they're going about bringing Walker up. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, was Zunino just a move to try and save jobs, or was Zunino a move because they have no catching depth in their system? And I think they've been through like seven catchers.
Maybe a combination of both. I mean, to infuse the roster with a young player, maybe an exciting player, maybe a player that can come in and get hot. But it's also, you know, necessity because they actually needed a catcher. But you know, you hear rumors of like, oh, well, maybe, you know, they have one more year because of the extension that was supposedly signed at the beginning of the year. But, you know, I mean, does he keep his job? We had that email question, you know, that one time. I mean, does he keep his job? The thing about DePoto came out, which was kind of strange to me.
That's not nearly as weird as the other stuff, because it's pretty clear that he and Socha have been on different pages. And
what do you think about that, though? I mean,
it's weird. The whole situation is weird. I mean, it went from this spot where, I mean, the perception was when Regans was in charge that Socha had a significant amount of power and was making the decision. They wanted to get somebody in to make their own decisions. And then the owner goes out and greenlights spending, you know, all the money on Pujols and Hamilton as opposed to upgrading pitching. And, you know, DePoto is an interesting dude. I don't know. Have you ever dealt with Jerry?
Yeah, I've dealt with him a few times.
I like him. I mean, I think he's a bright guy. And for a former player, he's, you know, very numbers friendly.
He's kind of handsome.
Oh no, he's very good looking, very very handsome man. but he kind of runs at odds with Socha, who's much more of kind of a old school National League feel manager. And I don't think that there's, you know, I don't know that they're really on the same page. But I mean, you know, I think a lot of people are trying to put blame on Socha in this, and I mean, shit, I just look at it as he hasn't had the pitching. You know, Weaver's good, but Weaver's not the same as he was. You know, I mean, Weaver's fastball came back a little bit this year, but, man, in April, he was 85-86 before he got hurt. You know, I mean, I know he's never been a guy to light up a radar gun, but for a 28-year-old, that's a little bit scary. You know, Wilson's been a pretty good sign for him, but they just don't really have anything else behind that in the rotation. And, you know, I don't know how you blame that on Socha. How do you blame Josh Hamilton not playing well on Socha? How do you blame Pujols being hurt on Socha? You know, especially when he's got 4 years left on his contract.
Well, personally, I would blame the front office for making those signs in the first place to that level, because, I mean, that's almost $400 million between those two players, basically. I mean, that's a lot of money for guys who are, you know, arguably, you could see how they were, you know, most certainly on their decline. But, I mean, it could be steep here, you know, and they're going to be – now they have to go out and they – I mean, he's one of the best players in the world, but they're going to have to give Trout, you know, a lot of money.
How much do you give Trout? What would you give Trout?
$200 million.
Would you do? What do you do? Like 10 and 200? I mean, I suppose you
would he take that?
I don't know. I mean, I mean, if he's what, one more year of pre-arb, right? So if you get a raise from,
you can't go to arb with him.
No. You got to try and lock him up before that. But you have to kind of. It's how you structure the deal, right? So, you know, can you reasonably give him $2 million? For his last year pre-arb, that might be a little rich. I mean, you can go to $200 million, but the last year of the contract, he's making $30 million. Well, there's risk in all that. I mean, Boris was talking about that this week with – he didn't say it, you know, like for certain, but he said like Harper – he was talking about 12-year deals, and he was talking about – I think he was specifically talking about Harper, but he didn't mention him by name, but how he was kind of in favor of them and how you could make him work. I mean, you think about it, Harper signs a 12-year deal now as a pre-arb. I mean, it'd take him through age 32 or 33. I mean, if I'm a team, I'm much more interested in doing that than signing a guy, you know, than signing a guy at 27 as a free agent, because I've got him for all those kind of build up to the prime years. Harper, I guess, is a little concerning because he was hurt this year because of how hard he plays. But I'd do 10, 12 year deals for either of those guys for around $200 million total. I'd do it for Machado too.
I would too. Obviously, if somebody offered me $200 million, I would take it. I'm not in their position, so it's really hard for me to relate. But if you can imagine what it would be like with these guys coming to free agency in their mid-20s, mid to early 20s, you know, they would set the market. Now, is that something that you would risk for, you know, you give up the security and go for the home run? I mean, not that $200 million isn't a home run, but can you imagine if Harper is Harper when he's a free agent, or Trout is still Trout when he's a free agent? Can you imagine what the price would be?
I mean, here's the thing. From their standpoint, if they stay healthy, does it make some sense for them to go to free agency because there aren't that many free agents anymore?
Well, and I mean, maybe there aren't going to be that many teams who can afford to give them a $250-300 million deal. I mean, there'll be teams out there that can compete against each other, but I mean, it's not going to be the largest pool. You know, I would take the security of $200 million, and you know, but that's because I'm never going to have that option. It's easy for me to say.
Well, there's not a great track record of guys who turn down 9-figure extensions, too. I mean, shit, you think Lincecum wish he'd accepted 5 and 100? When he was offered it 2 years ago?
Well, hell yeah.
I mean, you know, what was the Juan Gonzalez one? Wasn't that?
Oh, like, Jesus Christ. Oh, yeah.
With Detroit? Wasn't that like 120?
And then 120 or 140? Something just ridiculous.
And I think he only ended up making like 10 or 11 million bucks after that. I mean,
yeah, he only played a couple more years, right?
Right. We were having this conversation. I'd forgotten about this the other night. Somebody called in and was talking about it, but it was like 2005. Gonzalez signed with the Indians in the offseason. They signed him for $600,000. He goes out, has one at bat against Burley on opening day, and he's done. Career was over.
Jesus.
I mean, I had forgotten about that. I was at that game, too, and I completely had forgotten about it.
I never really liked Juan Gonzalez. I always thought that he was kind of a guy who, man, if it was a 7-0 game either way, Juan Gonzalez was going to hit something deep and late. And I know he had that one incredible series in the postseason, the first time the Rangers made it, when he, you know,
against
he hit five,
the Yankees, yeah.
Yeah, when he just dominated or whatever. But I never thought, like, when he came up in a key moment of the game, I never felt with him, for some weird reason as a fan, that, like, he was going to do something. I always believed in, like, Rusty Greer a lot more, or Pudge Rodriguez a lot more, or Palmeiro a lot more. I never really got into the Juan stuff. I mean, I thought his approach was shit at times, just all or nothing. Just a big Hulk up there with a great mustache and sometimes a Jerry curl, but would just swing from his ass.
What was the season, like, his rookie year, he was really good, and then he got huge, just, like, enormous, and then lost all his flexibility and then came back and was good beyond that.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. Would that have been, like, 89 or 90? I'm going to have to look it up now.
Look it up.
Can't remember.
He came up with a mustache. When he was a prospect, he had a mustache. Not many can pull that off.
I still remember I had like his, I would say like his Donruss card or something like that with like the pen. He pulled off the pencil thin. Right?
Yeah, the Harlem Renaissance mustache yeah. that he had for a while. Yeah, hell yeah.
I'm trying to think, where would this have been? This would have been, okay, so he hits the back-to-back 40 homer seasons and then he got huge. And I think he had 19. God, he didn't play. Man, that guy had 5 40 homer seasons. Shit, yes. I forgot about that. And 39 another time.
Well, and he was an RBI machine at times. I mean, that one year he was getting, what, he had 150 or something?
157. He had 100 at the break, I think, or close to it, if I remember right. They were talking about Hack Wilson for a while with him. He had 50 doubles that year, too. 50 doubles, 45 homers. You know what? He had the season that Chris Davis is having right now. And they're almost identical ages. Davis is 27 and Gonzalez was 28.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That is.
That's nuts. He won 2 MVP awards. Shit.
The Rangers were winning all kinds of MVP awards back then.
Who was your guy?
Growing up?
Yeah. Please say Otobe McDowell.
Don't get me started on McDowell. I loved Otobe. I loved the way he stuck his butt out when he hit. I loved how he was slappy. I think growing up, like, as I mentioned on the podcast before, I think it was I loved Buddy Bell because my mom had some sort of weird fascination with Buddy Bell, and she loved her some Buddy. She loved his golden locks, and I told you my brother has blonde hair, which is strange.
Right.
Pretty good with the leather too. so I liked Buddy Bell a lot, but I mean I loved Inky.
Yeah.
I mean, I was an Incavelia guy because he didn't give a shit. You could tell he didn't give a shit. You could tell he was like, you know, it's kind of like he was an early version of Napoli. You know, he had the jersey open. He had the chest scruff. He clearly smelled like beer from you could smell him through the television. You know, you knew that he drank canned beer and a lot of it. He had that little wiggle.
Uh-huh.
With that little butt wiggle that he would do, and he would strike out a ton, and then he would hit bombs. And that old stadium was tough to hit bombs in. And he would really, really send them out. He was really an impressive player, and I always, you know, he didn't look like a baseball player. He looked like a softball player.
Yeah.
Playing baseball, and I always respected that. So I always loved Inky. I got to see Pudge when he first came up. I got to see him gun Ricky Henderson when I was really young in one of his first seasons. Mm-hmm. And it was just electric to see a guy with that sort of game-changing skill set. You know, and it was before the Rangers were any good. You know, I spent my whole life watching the Rangers suck. And I was fine with it, you know, because I had the Cowboys and I didn't really care if the Rangers won or not. I just liked watching baseball. And once you started to put the pieces together with guys like that, with the Rusty Greers and the you know, Pudge and Palmeiro. And before then, I loved Will Clark. I thought Will Clark was the shit, man. I mean, speaking of just guys with just sour attitudes, he always had that look on his face of go fuck yourself.
He still has that look on his face.
But remember his swing and his stance? I mean, it was just so cool. You know, those were the guys that I had growing up. I mean, who were your guys?
Well, I was a big Dawson guy. When he came over to the Cubs in 87, I just thought it was the coolest that, like, the guy who, you know, at least got talked about in the conversation as the best player in the game, like, wanted to play for the Cubs so bad that he took a blank contract. Now, little did I know about collusion then, but I just thought it was the coolest. Like, he wants to come and play at Wrigley, and then he goes out and just fucking rakes in 87. I think he had, like, 49 homers that year. And
yeah, I remember that.
He was my favorite. I mean, still my favorite player, I think, ever, because he was just, and he was so classy, you know. I liked everything about Dawson. I loved the way he played the game. I loved the arm. I loved the kind of that closed stance with the hands way out over the head and the bat waggle. I loved it when he hit one over a true link fence at Wrigley Field. He used to do these commercials for, like, the chain link fence that's on the back of the Wrigley bleachers, that he would just the worst read you've ever heard. When I hit one over the fence at Wrigley Field, I hit one over a true link fence. It's just terrible. But I love Dawson. Dawson was definitely my guy. And other than him, I mean, there were, you know, like when I was, like, the first year that I really remember like following all the way through was 84, and the Cubs won the division that year. But it was like Richie Hebner, I thought, was fascinating because he was a gravedigger in the offseason. Like, he barely played. You know, I mean, Hebner was a good player in Pittsburgh for a long time. I mean, you know, I think he hit 300 a couple of years, pretty good third baseman, but he was just a bench guy. But when I learned that he looked like dug graves in the offseason, I thought that was the coolest shit in the world.
Jesus, that's strange, right?
Well, I mean, you got to think the money wasn't really rolling in until 80, 81. I mean, Hebner played most of his career in the 70s. That's how he worked out in the offseason, was he dug graves.
I mean, I guess it's really just digging, right? I mean, the fact that it's a grave is...
Yeah, I mean...
He's not putting the body in there, so he's just digging. He just digs holes.
Right, right, right. I mean, he wasn't working as a mortician. He was just working as a grave digger.
No, that would be an interesting way for a player to make money in the offseason.
Right.
Embalming and sticking fluids up an asshole.
Yeah, that would be great.
You know, another thing about Dawson is that, like Juan Gonzalez, I mean, even more so, he was wet.
Oh,
he had a
yeah,
mustache
he was
for
wet.
A while, but he was wet.
Dude, that was those were some luxurious locks. He was wet.
Absolutely. Oh, but speaking of wet, I need you to fill me in on the details because I missed it. What we were talking about last night on text with Trent.
Oh.
Because I didn't get all the details because I was, you know, Wednesday night I prepare for bath night.
Was that like you're lighting candles and like getting the scented oils ready?
I'm just arranging candles. It's all about, you know, it's part of it is aesthetics. You know, you can't just jump in water. That's just common.
So
it's for lake people.
So the Reds have been getting their asses handed to them by the Cardinals all season. I think they were like, I think the Cardinals were like 10-4 against them coming into last night. And they're like late after the game, they lose like 6-1 or something like that on Tuesday. And Brandon Phillips goes into Dusty's office and says, hey, if you want to move me around in the lineup, I'm cool with it. And he's like, can I announce it on Twitter? And Dusty said, yeah, it's going to be news anyway, so whatever. So they move Phillips into the two hole, and the two spot for the Reds has been just dreadful all year. I mean, I think they've got like a 270 on base, and they've gone through like Zach Cozart and Todd Frazier for the most part in there. Because Phillips was there on opening day, and then Ludwig dislocated his shoulder, and they shuffled the lineup because Dusty believes in protection, and so he wanted him behind Votto.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through this, and Trent tweets out last night before the game, you know, the Reds replace a guy with a 320 on base percentage of the guy with a 310 on base percentage in the two hole. That's it. That's all he says. And then he says, you know, Phillips on career line in the two hole, and he tweeted it out, the slash line, and it was almost identical to where it is other places, right? So this is all he says, right? So he goes in, and he had linked Phillips' Twitter account on, you know, on another tweet or two that said, hey, you know, he's moving to that spot in the lineup. So he goes in the clubhouse to ask Phillips about it, and Phillips is like, I'm not talking to you. I don't want to talk about the change. All right, so he goes into the manager's office, and they're doing the press conference, and in the middle of the talk with Dusty, Phillips comes in and starts calling Trent a fat motherfucker in front of everybody and saying, you know, hey, Dusty, this guy wants to hit me eighth. You should set him straight. He's tweeting about my on-base percentage. I'm sick of the negativity, dog.
Oh, my
he's
God.
He's like, I'm tired of the negativity on you. And Trent, he's like, I found out who you are on Twitter. And Trent goes, congratulations. It's about time. It took you long enough.
Yeah, he's been dealing with it for a long time.
Right. And so Phillips is still, you know, kind of, I mean, he called him a fat motherfucker probably four times in this like 30-second thing. And Dusty's sitting there, the videos of Dusty, and he's like got one of those smiles on his face like this is horribly uncomfortable.
Oh, and this is on video?
This is on video, yeah.
Jesus.
And that was the link I sent you, had a link to the video in it. And so, you know, Phillips finally goes out of the room and Dusty says, man, this is, you know, he looks at Trent and he says, this is between you and him. And Trent looks at him and he goes, no, this is between him and him, which is one of the all time great put downs. I think this is between him and him. So apparently Phillips was upset that he doesn't get on base more, and and took it out on Trent in a really unprofessional manner. And, you know, I've dealt with Phillips for a long time, and I've never had any problem with him. I don't know, you know, what he's like to cover locally. It's a lot different when you're the national guys and you come in, you only see guys for a day or so, or you're doing phone interviews and stuff like that. But I've never really, you know, heard that much about him. He's certainly opinionated. But I also think he was, you know, one of the things he was referencing was his 95 RBI hitting out of the four spot. And I think he's, you know, a little sensitive to the discussion that's been going on TV, where, you know, like on the MLB Now show, talking about Votto and his value to the team as opposed to Phillips, which is, you know, a lot has to do with the fact that Votto's been on base ahead of him. And that's why he has 35 more runs driven in than Votto is. And Votto's catching. I think Votto's actually caught more shit in Cincinnati than Phillips has, because Phillips is the one that's driving in runs and Votto isn't. Votto's got like 61 RBI this season, which, you know, I mean, I know that it's only as good as the people on base ahead of you, and there's been nobody on base in the second spot, but it just seems like an astronomically low total for a guy who's a power hitter like Votto is.
Well, so what do we take away from this? That just Phillips is an asshole? Well,
Phillips was being a dick. I mean, that's basically what it was.
Oh, does it speak to anything larger? I mean, when we were kind of discussing this last night a little bit, you know, do you need a player to realize, you know, what he is or what he could be, or, you know, the way that other people see his value? Do you need a player to recognize his own value?
The first thing.
Okay.
A player needs to recognize who he is. Brandon Phillips isn't going to be an on-base guy. You know, that's not and trying to change Brandon Phillips to be that guy is a mistake.
Yeah, he's a run producer.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, in his mind, he's a run producer, right? I mean, that's right. What he is. I mean, let's break it down even different than that. You know, what is Phillips really? Phillips is an aggressive hitter with some power who plays above average defense at second base. He's an incredibly valuable player for what he is. But he doesn't, you know, I don't think that Trent was trying to say, you know, he needs to be doing something different. Brandon just needs to realize he is what he is, you know, as far as a player goes, and not try and change it. I mean, especially 10 years into a big league career, I mean, you should have a pretty good idea of who you are, and I hope that he's comfortable with who he is because he got paid, and he's, you know, he's had plenty of success. I mean, how many All-Star games has he been to? Two, three? I mean,
yeah.
You know, the guy's been a really good player.
Well, I mean, obviously we're going to look past the fact that he was an asshole to a good friend of ours and try to be objective here. First of all, Trent,
did you?
Trent is America.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did you look past the fact that he was an asshole? I didn't.
I was trying to.
He was horrible to him. I mean, it was uncalled for. He's mine too.
I know. We both like the guy. Trent is America. He represents America. You know. So really, this is terrorism. You know, when you're attacking an institution like Trent, you know, obviously you want his, you know, him to show some tact, but I mean, I want a player to understand who he is and what he does, but I don't need a player to understand anything beyond that, to be honest with you. I just don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that a lot of this is just reaction. You know, a baseball player goes out and just reacts and does what he does on a field. I don't really need him to understand the same things that an analyst would understand when looking at the production after the fact, unless it takes away from his game on the field. What I don't want to do is a player thinking about their stats or their value to a team while they're out on the field. I just want them to do what they do. You know, I want it to be very natural and very easy, and I don't want them to be in their head a lot, such as like when we're talking about Castro, you know, a guy who go up there and change your game in order to fit an organizational philosophy. I don't think that that's a good idea.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I tell you this story. We were talking to Adam Jones earlier this year, and we were just talking. He was going through just kind of a little down spell, and you know, people are all over Jones. I think he's walked like 17 times this year. I mean, he's an aggressive hitter, and I just kind of asked him what I thought was an innocuous question about whatever, and he said, "Well, what I know I need to do is I need to walk more," and I wanted to reach through the radio and go, "Fuck you, man! You don't need to walk more. You need to be Adam Jones." You know,
right.
I mean, Adam Jones is a bad motherfucker because that bad motherfucker swings the bat, yeah. Right? I mean, that's who he is. No, don't. I mean, it's one thing to try and learn to get better, and if it's part of your skills, but if you're not comfortable doing it, don't try and make yourself something that you're not.
Do you think that like more teams need to, you know, if you want, you know, guys who get on base, like to construct your roster accordingly, and instead of trying to make every player do everything, You know, like have certain roles. Like if you, you know, you're the one who puts the roster together. It's your construct. So if you have a guy that's an aggressive hitter and you know he's not going to walk, then you use him for what he's good at. You know, if you have a power guy, you use him for what he's good at. When you have an on-base guy, you can create your lineup accordingly so that you can fit all these pieces in instead of trying to make every individual player have all of those traits.
I think at the major league level, yes, especially if you're coming in new to an organization. I mean, you have to. I mean, there's, you know, like even, you know, I know it gets talked about a lot with the Moneyball book and the Moneyball, you know, kind of movie with the A's and the pitching, but their best player for a good chunk of that was Miguel Tejada, who was not a Moneyball player. You know, Tejada never walked. You know, Tejada was an aggressive swinger. And yeah. I think what you have to do is you have to accept who the player is. You know, I think if you want to try and create an organization that values, you know, on-base percentage or values patience or values, you know, selectivity, then you need to draft players that are, you know, at least A, somewhat predisposed to it, and B, you preach it to them from the minor leagues up so that they get comfortable with it by the time they get to the big leagues, because at the big league level, you cannot think. You might be talented enough to think a little bit of double A and triple A, but you can't once you get to the big leagues.
Right.
And so I think it has to really start low, and I think it's dangerous, even if it's a young player, to try and change too much what they're trying to do. They need to kind of understand it for themselves, if that makes sense.
It does. No, I completely agree. I mean, yeah. It sucks that happened to Trent, though, man. He's a good guy. He doesn't deserve that kind of crap.
No, I agree. I totally agree. And I, you know, and I'll go a step further on the kind of like that, like what we were talking about with Castro, and we were talking about with patience and stuff like that. This was part of the talk we had with Bo Porter today. He was talking about Robbie Grossman. Mm-hmm. You know, Grossman's been a favorite of stat guys for a long time because he walks. I mean, he gets on base a ton, and Porter said he got up here in his first crack at the big leagues, he was making right turns, you know, making left turns the whole time because he was getting behind in the count because guys were pumping him strikes. And he said, I told him when we sent him back down, I said, Robbie, at this level, pitchers aren't going to walk you. They are going to throw you strikes until you prove that you can't hit them. And it was basically that, you know, that being a selective hitter comes with being a dangerous hitter. He said Grossman went down, and basically from the time he went down to Oklahoma City to the time he came back up, he's been swinging. And he's been getting to the fastball. He's not been thinking about it. He's got the foot down. And Grossman's been pretty good since they brought him back up. Now, I don't think this guy's, you know, a star-level player, and he may not be a regular or whatever. But I thought it was a pretty good, you know, story of what kind of has to happen between, you know, what we see with selectivity at the minor league level and what you have to do at the big league level in kind of actualizing it. Because guys are going to attack you. I mean, shit, we talked about that with the Royals and bringing it back to them early in the season. The problem, they weren't walking because they were passive. They were letting a lot of fastballs go by for strikes because they were so cognizant about trying to get into hitters' counts.
Right. Well, that's interesting, Michael.
No, it sure is, Jason.
Not as interesting as some of the – I mean, I guess you saw that – you sent me that, the Fall League roster.
Yeah.
Cool.
That
is really cool. There's a shitload of talent this year. I know there's a lot of – there's always good positional talent. There's some arms this year.
Oh, no, that was the thing that really stood out to me, at least compared to last year, was that there were at least some names. I mean, like Meyer is going down for Minnesota, I know. Holtzman is going to be there. I mean, it's a lot of guys that are rehabbing injuries. But, yeah, I mean, I was excited by the number of arms that were there. There are a couple of guys that have been pitching that pitch quite a bit in the big leagues that are going to be down there this year. I think Maurer's going down for Seattle. I'm trying to think. Somebody from Miami, I want to say, was going down too. He'd pitch quite a bit. But you don't usually see that at this point. I guess it's, you know, again, you're trying to get guys stretched out for innings because they haven't gotten to their limits.
Right. You want to look at a roster?
Yeah. You want to look at Mesa? Since that's the big – since you hate the Cubs system?
Since I hate the Cubs system and I hate the Cubs, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's – what is it you said to that guy the other day that you were going to intellectually sodomize him on the Cubs system?
He told me that because I have to focus on all 30 systems that he knows more about the Cubs system than me. And I said, you would be mistaken. I would intellectually sodomize you on the Cubs system. You know, I mean, I would put him, I would bend him over the seat.
Oh, that's good.
Not to mention that it, by not following all 30 teams, he has no relational perspective to the Cubs.
Right.
So every Cub prospect's got to be in the top, you know, the top 10 Cubs prospects would be the top 10 prospects in baseball because he doesn't know anybody else.
Right.
It doesn't matter. He spelled some words correctly, so I'm going to give him that.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's a step in the right direction for him. So.
Oh, yeah. So let me pull up this roster real quick.
So Mesa's got the Angels, the A's, the Cubs, the Nationals, and the Tigers. So, and the scariest thing is, like, Mike Muroth is the pitching coach for that team. Like, I remember when he lost 21 games. It wasn't all that long ago. Like, he's like my age. The pitching coaches in this league, hitting coaches are now my age. I'm feeling old.
Man.
You don't care. It's all right. You can just say you don't care.
I do care. I mean, you're not. I'm getting older too. So okay. Just okay. Looking at this roster, well, the pitchers aren't that exciting for this team. I mean, Vizcaino is interesting. I mean, I think that he's a reliever, but I mean, I think he definitely has a live arm.
He hasn't pitched at all this year. That's been
no.
Thing.
So I mean, there's a lot of guys on. This is like a typical AFL pitching roster, right?
I don't know, man. There's a couple of guys that are. I mean, they're at least famous. You know what I mean?
Perk.
You know,
Cam Bedrosian's got some really nasty stuff when he's on it.
He was a first rounder, wasn't he?
Yeah, a sub guy, I think.
He's a reliever long term, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think so.
I mean, if he had a career half as good as his dad's, that'd be pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, he's got some nasty stuff, man. There's not a bunch of high end guys. I mean,
right.
Perk is not Perk anymore, and you know, Vizcaino hasn't even been healthy. But I mean, when you're looking at this roster, you're not really looking at the pitchers. You're not really looking at the catchers. For me, my it starts to move a little bit when you get to the infielders. And let's just, I mean, look at this shit. Javier Baez, you know, Chris Bryant, Taylor Lindsay, Addison Russell. I mean, those are the infielders.
Right.
CJ Cron, I mean, there's some dudes there, but I mean, when you see Addison Russell, you assume, okay, he's gonna be playing shortstop. I assume Baez is gonna be playing third.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know where Bryant's gonna be playing. I assume he was gonna be playing some right field. Got to get that ready. I mean, that's just gonna be fantastic. Taylor Lindsay is a guy that I don't think enough people are talking about.
Yeah,
right
I don't
now.
Know a whole lot about him.
Taylor Lindsay, I always thought he was kind of a weak hit tool, like, but that was his carrying tool. No, not a ton of power. You know, set right. Side of the infield profile, you know, just a baseball player guy, but not an impact type of guy, or not even, you know, not a first division type of guy. But I mean, I've been getting some Roll Six reports on this guy.
Hmm.
Loud contact. He's got good pop. He's got a very good hit tool. He's improved at second. This is a player. You know, this guy could be the top prospect in the Angels organization.
Oh, that's interesting. That's. You know? I wonder if that's part of why they were at least open to dealing Kendrick. At the trade deadline, and why they might move him in the offseason is because they feel like they can get pitching for Kendrick, then they can slide Lindsay in there at some point. I mean, he's done it at Double A now, so.
Yeah, and the people that I've been talking to who have seen him do it at Double A, you know, they like the way he's doing it at Double A. They don't like the fact that, you know, it's not just because of the environment he happens to be in. It's that,
sure.
I mean, he's hitting the baseball, he's squaring the baseball, he's using the whole field, he's got some pop in there. You know, Addison Russell is clearly one of a top-tier guy in baseball. I mean, he was playing at an advanced level at a very young age. He was, you know, showing some really good pop. I think he's got a lot of opposite field power. I think that he's got just a really natural, loud contact type of bat. His defense is hit and miss. I mean, he can get to a ball, but then he can flub a ball. But I think that his hands are really, really good. You know, it's a lot like Baez, who we've seen explode in the second half here. You know, Baez still has a lot of problems. I mean, you can look at what he's doing hitting home runs, which is, you know, that's great. Don't get me wrong. A guy his age hitting bombs in Double A, the way he's hitting bombs, it's natural to say, why isn't this guy the number one prospect in baseball or whatever? But, you know, Javier Baez, you know, speaking of getting sodomized, Javier Baez would just get manipulated to shit at the major league level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is not a player who is quite as advanced as I think some of his Double A numbers have indicated. I think that he still plays the game, and you know, with his hair on fire, you know, and not always in a good way. I mean, he plays the game really quickly. He plays it very fast. He doesn't have a lot of nuance. His approach has gotten a little bit better. I mean, but he will still chase. He will still expand. Pitchers with a plan can still get him. The problem is that you know, even at the Double A level, he's still facing a lot of pitchers who don't have a really decent major league valuation, if one at all.
Right.
And so you make a mistake to Baez, he's going to get you. He has some of the best bat speed you'll see. You know, he has the best bat speed in the minors, as far as I'm concerned. You know, between him and like Clint Frazier, I think those are just two extreme bat speed guys. I think that he's going to be able to hit for an absolute ton of power if he can connect enough. I don't, you know, I do worry about the swing and miss only because it's the way he swings and misses. I mean, he will come out of his shit. You know, if you can, if you start him, like, especially like righty-righty slider, if you start him outer third, he'll go all the way. He'll follow that ball 6 inches out, 10 inches out. You know, he's had some struggles with some vertical heavy pitches, you know, curveballs that start, you know, middle down and then just dive. You know, he has some trouble tracking that kind of stuff because of the way he generates his bat speed. So he really brings that bat through the zone. He doesn't have a ton of control. You know, I think that he's obviously a monster talent. He might have moved up, be above Almora at this point in the Cubs system. But I mean, I'm still a big Almora fan, and he's a taxi squad member,
right?
So
right.
he's on the squad as well. You know, Brian Goodwin's on the squad. He's a guy that has been an up and down guy this year.
Yeah, he's had a rough year, but man, I really liked him when I saw him in Arizona last year. He's got really fast hands at the plate.
He does, and you have to like the tool package. I mean, mm-hmm. He's athletic. He can run. He's got some feel for baseball. He's not just an athlete,
right? And he was selective too. I mean, that's the one thing about this season is he's been a little bit more selective. It's just been just kind of a challenge for him to put together results.
Yeah, and now he's getting to the point that, like, you know, next year he's at a more advanced age. It's time for him to start like putting together these tools into a baseball package. And I think that he could get there. I mean, Soler, there's an interesting guy. I mean, he had a really disappointing year with the suspension and then the injury. But when he was healthy and on the field, he was starting to show people what was up. You know, he was starting to show people that, oh man, this could be a prototypical corner guy, the guy that the Cubs thought that they were getting in the first place, a guy that they thought could move quickly. I think that a healthy Soler next year is on a rocket ship.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I think that he's fantastic. I wouldn't put him above Almora because what Almora can do is he's going to stay in an up the middle position. You know, as much as I like Baez, there's some question marks about whether he's, despite the hands, that he's a true shortstop. You know, can you put up with his wild play at shortstop until he matures in that regard? Now, Almora is a mature center fielder. I think that he doesn't have the type of tools that are as loud as Baez or even as loud as Bryant, but I think that he's kind of like a 5-6 guy across the board, and those guys are still pretty rare, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't see a lot of 5-6 guys across the board who play up the middle premium positions. I think that Almora, you can make a case that he's a top 10 prospect in baseball just based on the upside. So I mean, this is a fantastic roster. Yeah. I mean, it's mostly, I mean, the Cubs horses are make it really attractive. But like guys like Lindsey and Addison Russell and you know, Brian Goodwin and guys like that. And then, you know, on the pitcher side, it's not, as we talked about, it's not that sexy. But
Solis is interesting, at least. I mean, he missed most of the season coming back from Tommy John, but he's not a nothing. I mean, maybe he's a reliever in the end, but that's something, certainly.
No, it's something, yeah. I mean, he's been hurt most of his career. He hasn't been able to put it together. He's, you know, 24 years old, isn't he?
Yeah.
No, he's 20, or is he 25?
This is a really good collection of former, I mean, good college pitchers that are on this too. I think Benincasa was the, was a closer at I want to say Florida State, and you know, Michael Roth might be the best big game college pitcher of all time, and he's had a little big league time this year. And Knebel was at UT, right? He's the one that he got suspended for taking a piss test for one of his teammates so that they wouldn't fail a drug test.
Yeah, he made some interesting decisions there towards the end, right before he was drafted.
I mean,
made a series of them. I think there was some fighting, there was some drinking.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he was standing up for a teammate at least, so there's that.
Yeah, there's loyalty.
Right. So, I mean, it's not, you know, there are at least kind of names that are in that bunch if they're not, you know, even if they aren't great ones overall.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that the Cubs are sending the, you know, what they're calling the big four now out of that. If you had to guess, I mean, not on ceiling, just from looking at those four guys, so that who's the guy that you think ends up being the best player out of the four of them?
Oh man, that's a really great question. I think that I wouldn't bet against Bryant.
Yeah, that's the guy I think it's going to be.
Just because I think I think Almora is going to play in the majors, man. I mean, Baez is going to play in the majors. Soler is going to play in the majors. Bryant's definitely going to play in the majors, but. Bryant's floor is really, really high,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't think that it's going to take him long to show people that. I mean, I think he's up at the major league level next year at some point, and, you know, he's going to be able to hit. How much he hits and if he turns into, you know, a middle-of-the-order monster, then I think that that's to be determined, but I think he's going to be a major league regular at worst. Now, with a guy like Baez, he has the highest ceiling for me. I think that he has, you know, true all-star potential because of the pop and the bat. I mean, I've seen this guy go 440 over the batter's eye. This guy has comparable power to Sano. You know, and he can, he's a better defender than Sano because he can actually play shortstop right now. I think that there's some maturity that needs to come into his game as far as, like, as I've mentioned about him slowing the game down and having a little bit more nuance, but all the tools are there for him to be a well above average major leaguer. Now, there's more risk with Baez, despite the fact that he's crushing in Double A. There's still some risk there. I think there's more risk with Baez than there is with Almora, and Almora is at a lower level. You know, there's more risk with Soler. You know, and there's some. I mean, Soler is it could be a prototypical corner guy, but there's some things that, you know, people don't like about it. There's some things that make some scouts question whether he's going to be able to hit for some average. You know, his arm comes and goes. Is there a work ethic issue? I mean, these are things that I'm just asking.
Right.
But I would pick Bryant.
Yeah, I think I probably would too, but I think it's also the safest bet because I'm with you that Baez is the guy. I mean, just when you talk to – you know, Baez is one of those guys that if you look at him on TV – I can't remember who you used – you may have used this example with Clint Frazier. Like if you were to look at the guy and like the average fan or somebody who didn't follow baseball and you were saying, tell me who has the best bat speed, it'd be really easy to pick up with Baez. Like it shows up on television how fast his bat is. And – you know, I think the one thing that's been, you know, interesting about it, and people, you know, may have read too much into it, but like when Soler had the suspension, when he kind of went after the dugout, the guy that held him back was Baez. And there were a lot of questions about Baez and from the makeup standpoint, you know, coming out of high school. But it doesn't seem like that's been nearly as big an issue in the minor leagues as, you know, some people worried about it being. And that's why I'm kind of interested to see what happens if he's working at it to get better. You know, I mean, that's the thing is if you can put together the work ethic, and who knows, maybe being around Bryant, you know, sparks him because Bryant's got that work ethic. You know, Bryant wants to be a really good player. And I'm not saying that Baez doesn't, but if he does and he's around Bryant and sees his work ethic, maybe it takes him to another level too. I mean, I think that's one of those things that we have a tough time quantifying, but there are some guys that are able to get through to teammates because of both of their competitive nature.
No, I agree. I agree. But I mean, if Bryant does, if he can rub off on a guy like Baez, if Baez continues to the maturation process both on and off the field, he's the monster in that. I mean, as good as Bryant could be, I still think that Baez has the higher ceiling. I think that he could be, you know, even if he moves to third base, I mean, it doesn't matter where he's going to move. You could make him a DH for all I give a shit about. He's going to hit a ton if the bat really gets there. I mean, the power is extreme. I mean, he could hit 40 home runs. That's no joke. You know, he's got such incredible bat speed, and he's able to generate such easy power. Like, he has natural loft in his swing. When he connects, the contact is extremely loud. There's backspin. It goes out.
I just always wonder, you know, we're focused on the high-end kind of prospects in their system. And, you know, like next week or the week after we'll do the team. You know, we'll keep going through these rosters. But, like, with both the Cubs and with Houston, you know, one of the things I keep thinking about is what happens if these guys get hurt. You know, what ends up happening to, you know, your kind of plan without major league-ready guys if you have some injuries in the minors? And the Cubs have kind of seen it with Soler and with Almora. I mean, Almora has been down for a couple of different things this year. Mm-hmm. Soler had the stress fracture. I mean, that's awful, you know, what he went through. And not that what Almora had, you know, went through isn't. It's just that there have been a couple of different things with him, and you wonder if that's, you know, I guess you don't like to label guys as injury-prone when they're in the minor leagues, but if the injuries keep, you know, popping up or if they prevent them from getting there, you know, how – you know, which team is better prepared, or who's better prepared when it comes to the depth from the depth standpoint? You know what I mean? Like with those high end guys, you can't really replace them in terms of what their upside is compared to maybe guys that are, I don't want to say organizational, but maybe more, you know, role five players.
Good points.
I just always am kind of curious by that as that works out. I mean, that's because I think it shows up at the big league level then too. So.
That's an interesting point, Mitchell.
Thanks a lot, James. Or Robert, I should say. Robert.
So I was drinking in Kansas City after the event and, yeah. With a lot of podcast listeners.
Yeah.
You're loved.
Oh, am I?
You were loved and you were missed. And yeah.
Well, thanks.
You were, as it turns out, you're the star.
No. There is only one star in this. That's you. You are the
Somebody
star.
Somebody called me the star. Joe called me the star. And like a couple of people were like, man, what the fuck? It's just star. The fuck, adding shit to it? It's just star.
I think I saw it's amazing how your terminology is permeated. I saw an agent tweet something at you the other day that said sparkle. It's like, Jesus.
Hey, what's really good, though, is that now that the merchandise deal is going through, we're going to have Baseball Perspective shirts coming at people in a couple of weeks that have,
oh, really?
Like, hashtag want, hashtag sparkle, hashtag rig, hashtag wet.
Are you going to have the shirtsies that have three on the back and they have follow Mort for the name?
Well, that would be fantastic, but I'm going to let Mort sweat for a little bit.
Old blue blood?
Yeah, but I tell you what, I would absolutely wear a wet shirt or a rig shirt. I cannot wait to like wear a rig shirt in public.
Who was the guy? Was it Mike Vogel, I think, was the listener who tweeted us a picture of his kid.
Oh my
spelling
God.
Rig with the magnets on the wall while in the bathtub.
Oh, I
don't
so
care if
good.
It was staged or not. That's the best photo ever. That thing was tremendous.
Absolutely. That made my night. I was doing my bath night prep. And like you sent that to me, and I was like, you know, experimenting with some candles, and I don't even have a bathtub, so that's even weirder. And then like you sent me the kid in the bathtub, and made me think of bath night and rig. So that kid was just having it. He does his on Wednesday. He has a bath night on Wednesday. That's really cool. Yeah. I'm glad he does.
Yeah, we should have hashtagged it back bath night. So,
we can try it.
So, what are you doing this week?
I'm going on another trip. I'm flying to Washington State.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Do you ever stop traveling?
I don't, because when I get back home, I'm like, I'm only home a week, and then I'm going to go do instructs for 10 days. And when I get back from that, then it's almost time to go do the amateur stuff.
Oh, in Jupiter, yeah.
Yeah, so no, I don't. But, you know, we're doing the top 10 list early this year.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to start rolling those out after the minor league playoffs in the third week of September. So we're already starting to get the construct we want. It's going to be similar to last year, and then start moving forward with those and the advanced scouting series. So I'm absolutely crushed. We're done with the BP events, so now it's just time to wrap up some scouting and to start really, you know, getting to the prospect list, getting all the information, talking to everybody that I know in the business, talking to everybody that I have on my staff, and just really crushing it. So I'm really looking forward to that. What do you have going on?
I'm going to Chicago this weekend to go see my my family. Little brother and his wife had a baby back in March, and only been out once. My wife hasn't been out to meet him, so we're going to go out and see them, spend a couple of days with them, and then meet up with some friends in the city on a Sunday, and then fly home like early on Monday. And then it's just, you know, I mean, it's hardcore baseball for me. I'm watching tons of games a day, and I'll get up to Baltimore for a couple of games in the White Sox series and the Yankees series beyond that. So, you know, it's just kind of getting to the park. I'm more focused on the big leagues now than I think my minor league season is over ahead of theirs, just because I got so much stuff. And then, you know, I'm waiting for the AFL. I'm hoping to be able to get out to Arizona for a little bit of time in November this year. So,
oh, that'd be good.
Yeah.
That'd be good. I think Cole's going to go out there, and I think that we've convinced old Mort to go out there.
Yeah, I'm not going to go then.
Well, you know, just don't go to a spelling bee with him, and you should be fine.
Oh, no, I don't have any problems with Mort. It's the fact that Cole's going to be there.
Well, then don't get into a discussion about UT or anything while you're out there.
Jeez.
With
him. I think they're actually going earlier than I am. I'm not going to – I'll probably go after all the good pitchers are shut down, because I got to wait till after the Major League playoffs to go. So,
yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll have a good time. Maybe you and Cole can like get a room together or something.
Just, yeah, that'd be
in
swell.
The same room.
That'd be swell. That's exactly what I need. You need two fat asses like us together. That's not a good idea.
Maybe one bed. Maybe just a king size bed. You guys can just have some, you know, some baseball time, some tummy stick time.
That's what we dream of. So, this has been the Fringe Average Podcast for this week. Our music came from a listener, Thomas Olterzewski, who is a Philly-based composer, so a little classical music for you. He's currently a Department of Performance Studies Fellow at the Curtis Institute of Music, so you can check his stuff out at on SoundCloud, and you can go to his website, and I'll spell it for you, Thomas, OLTARZEWSKI.com. If you want to email the podcast, we did have good emails this week. We just decided that we wanted to show off some Slack and chat. Would you just email us, fringeaverage@baseballperspectus.com. Jason's on Twitter at Professor Parks. I'm at Mike Farron, SXM, and the podcast is at Fringe Average. And you can join the Facebook group if you haven't already, facebook.com/groups/FringeAverage Podcast. We have almost 1,000 members of the Facebook group.
That's very cool.
I think only about 200 of them are spam bots that put up shit about being able to watch, I don't know, HBO for free or something on the internet. So.
Hey, man.
So that's good.
Good programs on, that network.
Yeah, so. All right. So we'll do this again next week?
Yeah, I'll be around.
All right. Sounds good. So will I.
All right.
Later.
Bye.